is not David and Absalom, is in fact David and Amalek. Now, Amalek is not really a person per se, it's an entity. But the relationship that David has with the entity is an important, I think, without understanding David's relationship with Amalek, it is essentially impossible or difficult to understand what really justifies the kingship of David. And kind of the sad thing, not a sad thing, but the limited thing that we have is that in a sense we're limited because of our haftarah, of the way our haftarot are set up in our weekly haftarot. We do Shaul versus Amalek, and we use that as a basis of our understanding of what it is we need to do about Amalek. But in fact, the parak of Shaul and Amalek, which, if you want, I'm sure we'll be referring to a little bit, it's in the Chumashim, which is in Perek Tetvav 15 of Sefer Shmuel Aleph, and it's the Haftarah of, goodness gracious, what's the Haftarah of the war against Amalek? I guess it's Parshat Zachor, if I'm not mistaken. Parshat Zachor's Haftarah. The parak Tetvav, the story between Shaul and Amalek, does not stand by itself. It is, I don't want to say it's meaningless by itself. However, it was designed by the Nevi'im who wrote Sefer Shmuel to contrast to the second battle against Amalek, which is none other than David's. Except we don't read that in Haftarah, so people aren't very familiar with it. Also, it's at the very end of the Sefer. It's in Perek Lamed out of Lamed Aleph. So nobody ever gets there when they're teaching it, because like you usually run out of time by Chaf Hei or Chaf Vav. No teacher ever really makes it to the end of the list. They just spend the last few weeks quickly going through the parsha, none of the kids are listening anyway. So most people are not as familiar with the story as they need to be, and too familiar, in fact, with the story of Shaul. It is only when contrasted with the one war of Amalek, the first failed war against Amalek, which is Shaul's, and we'll see whether it really is failed or not failed, and the successful war of David against Amalek, only by comparing the two will the personalities of Shaul, who is the failed king, contrast against the personalities of David, who is the successful king. The reason why the Navi puts them there is to have them compare and contrast them, and that's really what we're going to, that's what we're going to do. In that sense, we're going to spend a lot of time with Shaul, because again, one needs to understand David's success in light of Shaul's failure, because they're both put into the same sefer. I'm going to backtrack and state some of the obvious. Hopefully I won't bore you with some of the things that you probably already know. But the first question is, who is Amalek? So Amalek, I don't know, does anybody know where Amalek actually comes from? They're in the land of Canaan, but to whom do they belong? That is, what, in a relationship sense, which tribe do they come out of? That's right, they come out of Esav. That's exactly right. It says in, this is where I apologize. I have my source sheets, I don't have yours. I will read it out loud, though, and translate. It's in Bereshit, if anybody's curious and they have a Tanakh, it's in Bereshit, Perek Lamed Vav, right when it's going through, essentially, Eile Toldot Edom. This is the Toldot of Esav, who Edom. And it says, V'timna haita pilegesh Eliphaz. Timna was a pilegesh of a guy named Eliphaz, who was the son of Esav. V'tela Eliphaz et Amalek. Gave birth to Amalek. Now Amalek became one of the senior members of Esav, because a little later on in Pasuk Ted Vav, it says, Eile alufei b'nei Esav. These were the generals, really. Edom was broken up into two different political structures. One was Melech Edom, who we meet, and the other one are the Alufei Edom. The Melech Edom was really a king of Edom, and the Alufei Edom were more like warlords. Each one had a separate power base. In fact, each one had a different country, and it gets a little complicated when Bnei Israel are wandering around and they ask Edom for water, and Edom won't let them travel through their land. It's not as simple as meets the eye, because they're actually two separate governmental agencies of Edom. Eile Alufei Esav, Bnei Eliphaz, Bechor Esav, Eluf Teman, Eluf Omer, Eluf Sepho, Eluf Knaz, Eluf Korach, Eluf Gatam, Eluf Amalek, and then a few other Alufim as we go on. So essentially, they're a Semitic tribe, in a sense. And not only Semitic, they're an Avrahamic tribe. So they're really quite close family members, and I think that should affect the way we understand why we deal with them the way we deal with them, which is what I'll discuss a little bit later on. They are so important, however, Amalek is so important, that even before Amalek is ever born, their land is referred to. Let me explain what that means, because it's an important thing to understand when you're dealing with Tanakh. When the five kings are battling, if you remember, the four kings come out of Mesopotamia. They were Kedar Laomer, Adulam, I forget all their names. So they come out of and they come out of Mesopotamia to attack Eretz Yisrael, or at that time Canaan. And one of the places, the last places that they take is Ein Gedi, and Kol Eretz HaAmaleki. So the first question that you might have from a biblical criticism stance is, well, how could they mention that they took all the Eretz Amaleki if that's, I don't know, 50 years before, 50 to 75 years before Amalek was born? This shouldn't really surprise anybody. The Torah was written in the end during Moshe's 40th year. That is, the Torah, it's a machloket in the Gemara, whether the Torah was given what's called Megillot Megillot, which means as things happened. You ever wonder about that? You ever read the Torah and you're like, how did, if they got the Torah at Har Sinai, then how did they know about what Bilam was going to do? You ever wonder that? It's kind of a classic kids question, and nothing personal if you're asking it today. It's a classic, that's a bad way to put it. It's a classic question, but it's not a strong question, because the Torah was not given at Har Sinai. The Aseret, the Dibra were given at Har Sinai. The Mishnah Torah was given at Har Sinai. The Mishnah Torah is Devarim, Prakim, Vav, until Prakim, Chaf, which talk about when you come to the land and how to lay siege and how to give the first fruits. That was given at Har Sinai. Mishpatim, according to the Rambam, all the laws, like if I gore you and you gore me, or my car knocks into your car, who has to pay? According to the Rambam, that was actually given before Har Sinai to sort of prepare the nation from a kind of a humanistic sense to accept the Torah. According to the Rashi, it was given also at Har Sinai. But the story about Bilam was not given at Har Sinai. It was not. It didn't happen. It wasn't Moshe doing Nevuah. It didn't happen. The story about Korach is not at Har Sinai. The story about Shlach was not at Har Sinai. There's a machloket in the Gemara about how the Torah was given. According to one Tana, it's Megillot, Megillot, Nitnu. That is, as the chapters happen, Moshe wrote them down, whichever chapters he felt were of a Nevuah sense. God said, hey, write this down and write it this way. And then they were given as things went by. After the Korach story, Moshe scribed up the Korach story, Al Pi Hashem, and then he gave it to the people so they could sit and think about it. And all the laws, piece by piece, as he got them. The most classic one, of course, is Benot Tzlafchad, right? The Benot Tzlafchad come and they say, we want this land, we don't know what to do. Moshe says, you got me, I have no idea what to do either. So he goes to God, God creates a new law. Obviously, Moshe writes it down and gives it to the people at the time. Benot Tzlafchad are towards the end of Moshe's life in the 40th year. So the machloket is, either it's Megillot, Megillot, Netanu, it was given as things happen, or Kulo B'Sefer Achat Netanu, or it was all given in one book. But according to the Tana that says it was given in one book, that doesn't mean one book at Har Sinai. That means one book when Moshe is writing the Sefer in Vezot Abrachav, and Atan Lahamita Torah, Vesamotel Betocha Aron, and he put it in the Aron. And according to both opinions, the Torah was not sealed, signed, and delivered until the 40th year. So therefore, it should surprise nobody, and this has really been a long sort of aside, but I think it's an important side when it comes to understanding Tanakh. All of the Sfarim are edited at the end of the life of the author, and therefore the author has the ability to make certain editing. Now, in the case of Moshe, he has very little leeway because of Divrei Hashem. With the Sefer Nevuah, the Navi can pick and choose which Nevuahs he thinks are most appropriate. With the Sefer Ketuvim, essentially, since that's not Ruach HaKodesh, it's not Ruach HaKodesh, the Anshei Knesset Kol has a lot of leeway, but essentially it's not over until it's over. Therefore, Amalek, of course, when Moshe is writing about Amalek, he knew that people would know that territory, not from what it was once called, but what from people know it now, which is the meanest, baddest tribe to live in this area now, which is the Amaleki. Therefore, when the four kings are fighting the five kings, it's speaking of as Ste Amaleki. And it really should bother nobody that, there's somebody making mistakes in the Torah. It's not a mistake at all. In fact, it's the right thing to do. Moshe is writing the Torah. He wants to give people a geographical reference. You're not going to use a geographical reference that people don't understand. You're going to use a geographical reference that everybody understands, which is the Amaleki. Where was this geography? That's very important. We'll get to that in a little bit. Of course, the story is pretty famous, which is that the Bnei Yisrael were in a place called Rephidim, which is 3 days outside of Har Sinai, at Har Horeb. They get attacked from behind by Amalek, and everybody's very upset. Interestingly enough, Yehoshua, who was not a prophet at this time, but the general of the army, was sent to go down a three-day march, essentially, from where Moshe was, to fight the Amaleki in a very spiritual battle. Whenever Moshe raised his hand, Yehoshua was winning. Whenever Moshe got tired and his hands got put down, the Amaleki were winning. It was a tough battle. When it says in the Pasuk that the Amaleki were winning, one should immediately translate that as to Jews were dying. And that should be just a direct translation. You know, it wasn't some kind of video game where each side decided, I'm winning or not winning. It was a vicious, deadly battle. I'll describe how deadly it was a little bit later on, because it touches on spiritualisms and spiritual issues and not just governmental issues. Yoshua wins the war, but he's not destroy Amalek. He says, Vayachalesh et Amalek. He makes them weaken. Amalek runs away to lick its wounds, and the Jews are commanded a command, which is to always wipe out Amalek. Now let's talk about exactly what that command is, to wipe out Amalek. So what I'd like to do is talk about, first of all, I'd like to say why, the question I'm asking is why must we destroy them? And I'm sure you've all heard Dvar Torahs on it, and it's a favorite topic of pulpit rabbis everywhere and non-pulpit rabbis everywhere. I want to give the easy answer so far, and I think I can only really give the complex answer, the spiritual answer, after we understand the battles of David and Shaul against Amalek. The easy answer of why we must destroy Amalek is because God said so. Zchorat asher asah lecha Amalek, b'tzeicha v'derech Mitzrayim. And let me read actually the pasuk directly if I have it. I don't think I do. V'machoim ched zecher Amalek, and erase the memory of Amalek. So God says so. The question is, why did God say so? The Rambam adds in a new twist, though. The Rambam says like this. Shalosh mitzvot mitzdavu Yisrael b'shakni satan la'aretz. There were three commandments that the Jewish people were given as they came into the land. One, l'mnot lehem melech, to appoint a king. Shenem arsom tasim alech melech, because it says you shall appoint yourselves a king. Two, l'hachrid zaro shal Amalek, to destroy every last seed of Amalek. Three, to build a Beit Mikdash. The Rambam then goes on to say that one must appoint a king before one tries to destroy Amalek. So already we see that there's a connection between kingship, that is, it seems to be the defining factor of the king to go fight Amalek. So it should be no surprise that we see a battle of Shaul against Amalek, and then a battle of David against Amalek. The Rambam goes further on in his Sikkum to the Sefer HaMitzvot. He says the following. He says, "V'kishehistakel kol elu hamitzvot." The Rambam is talking about a very interesting fact, which is that we're all commanded, of course, we think we're commanded 613 mitzvot of the Torah. This is false, of course, because if you're not a Kohen, you're minus about 50 to 100. And if you didn't murder somebody by accident, which we hope not to do, then you're minus 1 or 2. And if you're not a king, you are not commanded to destroy Amalek. I want to repeat that because it's commonly misknown. Let me read it inside. Kishistakel al kol elu hamitzvot. If you look at all these mitzvot, shekadam zochram, which I've already mentioned, hinei timsa mehem mitzvot shehim chova al hatzibur. There are some which only have a responsibility for a tzibur to do, or when a tzibur is represented by a king, for the king to do. And that's an important distinction, because really, if you think about it, there were really two peoples that we were supposed to destroy when we came into Eretz Yisrael. One, of course, was Amalek, and the other parallel destruction was the Shiva Amim. But the Shiva Amim, the Rambam says specifically, is a chova on a yachid. That is, theoretically, if you came over to a Shiva Amim, and you personally saw a Shiva Amim, you would have to kill that person, by the way, under a certain condition, which I'll get to in a second. An Amaleki, however, it's not true. It's simply not true. The Rambam says beferish. If you are a yachid and you see an Amaleki boy sitting around or an Amaleki man, you have no commandment to kill him outright. It is only the responsibility of the tzibor, or better, when the congregation is represented by the king, it is only the responsibility of the king. That puts a commandment. And yet, interesting, there are a lot of comparisons. To destroy them all, if they make war with you, you have to wipe out the women and the children, which we're going to get to, that very touchy, anti-humanistic subject as we go on. And there are so many things which are common in those two commands. They're both considered Melchamet Mitzvah. In fact, the Rambam mentions that there are only three types of Melchamet Mitzvah. One is against Amalek, one is against the Shiva Amim, the seven nations, and one is whenever a Jew is in trouble, the king has responsibility to save the Jew or the Jewish group. So there's a lot of parallels, and yet, while the actions that one must perform on the Amaleki or the seven nations, the seven nations are similar, who has to do that actions is totally different. Totally different. And the question is why? Why is Amalek a kingship defining factor and the Sheva Amim a personal factor? I'd like to mention, by the way, the Rambam says clearly, and it's absolutely true, there is no more Sheva nations. He says, Lo nimtza shmam, they simply do not exist anymore, and therefore the mitzvah of the seven nations is null and void, not only Bizman Azeb, but Bizman HaRambam. What that means on a practical political level for the 21st century, I dare not go into. Yes, what is your question?
It's I guess a practical question.
Shaul
would
have
all the Amalekites except for the king, I got it right, and a bunch of other women and children.
I'm going to get to it in a second.
How much later was David that all of a sudden there was another Mother Nation kind of war?
Excellent question. In fact, that question belies your first statement. It causes one to suspect the truth of your first statement. And in fact, that's exactly what I want to discuss now. But before I discuss whether Shaul did, because that's our impression, right? Shaul wiped out everybody except for Agag. In fact, we know a famous medrash, or we unfortunately misknow a famous gemara, which is that when it says, Haman ha'agagi, it was because on the last night between the time that Agag, the king, who Shaul had allowed to live, got captured, until the time that he was killed, he managed to escape his chains, seduce or rape a woman, and have a baby from it. Gemara never says any such thing. It's a misread of the Gemara. What's that? Well, he was in jail. That is what is the general consensus. I think if you ask 99 out of 100 people or more, that's what they'll say. It's not what the Gemara says. It can't be what the Gemara says, and I'll show you what the Gemara does say and explain to you within the context of the battle of Shaul against Amalek. But before we discuss how many people he let live, let's first discuss a very strange command. If you have the Sefer, the similarities we mentioned are essentially what you have to do to them are the same between Amalek and the seven nations. However, we know that the seven nations, you have to destroy the men, the women, the children. And by the way, before we go any further, I'd like to say that the Rambam and the Ramban are absolutely clear that if Amalek or the seven nations want to make peace with Bnei Israel at any time, you must accept the peace. Surprise, right? You must accept the peace, just in case you don't believe me, because it's a little hard to believe. It seems to be going in favor in the Gemara. I don't know if you know in Devarim, in Parakhah, it says specifically that the people you're allowed to live are the Mechemet Rishut. That's the nations that are far away outside of Eretz Yisrael. But the nations that are inside of Eretz Yisrael, you must destroy them, man to woman, child, everybody around. The Rashi says that's true. Ramban and Rambam are cholik on the Rashi completely. They say the only difference between a faraway nation and a close-by nation, which is Amalek and the seven nations, is that if they don't make peace with you, then you're responsible to kill the men, the women, and the children. However, if they make peace with you, you may not kill anybody. And that doesn't mean, according to Rashi, what that meant was, it's a medrash, that meant that before Yoshua got into Israel, he sent out letters, but after Yoshua got to Israel, there was no more chance for peace. The Rambam and Ramban totally annul that. They say it's not true. You could be 2 minutes away from their door with knives and guns drawn, and if Shiva Am go time out, peace, you make peace with them. What that means politically in the 21st century, I also dare not go into. But let me read the Ramban so it's absolutely clear. Oh, right. It's a misread of the Chumash, and I don't have time to
tell. Because you're not supposed to follow their...
That's right. You know what the Ramban says? Therefore... And you're absolutely right, except then the question is, so how can the Ramban go against the Tanakh? But the Ramban says that it's not being cholek if they don't make peace, it's only being cholek when they don't make peace. Let me read the Ramban. V'im lo v'shlimu, if they don't make peace, he's talking about some battle, we'll explain what it is in a second. V'lo kiblu sheva mitzvah, and they don't take all seven mitzvah, which means they don't become essentially ger tzedek. Osim mehen milchama v'horgin kol ha'tzcharim ha'gulim, you have to kill every adult male. Ubozizim kol mamonam v'tapam, and you take all of their booty and their children, tapam and children. V'ein horgin isha v'lo katan sh'nemar v'anashim v'atapim tapshol tzcharim. And you do not kill any women or children. V'med v'arim amurim, when do these words apply? V'lochemet harashut. That's only in a war that you make outside of Israel, if you happen to want to conquer some nation. Shehu im shar hamot, which is with, I don't know, some other nation, not the seven nations, not Amalek. Listen carefully. Aval shiva amamim ba'amalek, shelo hishlimu. If they don't make peace, ein menichin hem neshama, then you don't allow anybody to live. Shenemar, kein taseh v'chule. Rak me'arei hamim tefiyat kol neshama. V'chein hu omer ba'amalek, tinchad sefer amalek, u'minayin she'im daver elo ve'elu shelo ishlimu, and how do I know it's only talking about the ones that did not make peace? Story of Yehoshua about people come and they make peace with Yehoshua even though it was a trick. The Rambam is absolutely clear. One can and in fact must make peace with the nations that are in Eretz Israel, and if so, you kill nobody. I know you're up in arms. And if you had time, it would take at least a full shiur to carefully go through the words, because you have to explain. The Rambam didn't make it out of nowhere. Not only that, everybody's holy. Only the Rashi says it. Only Rashi. He's a dot yachid, they now kill him. And yet it's become sort of a natural understanding. We believe that anybody in Eretz Israel, you have to kill. Only the Rashi says such a thing. Only Rashi. You certainly can. But you'd have to go against Rambam, Rashi, Chizkuni. You'd have to go against something. I'm sorry, you'd have to go against the Rambam and Ramban, and you'd have to go against essentially every other parish that touches on it except for the Rashi. Rashi is essentially a dot yachid. I'm not saying that you can't go with Rashi. And Rashi, what's that? I would say, if he had Ruach HaKodesh, I'd like to believe they didn't have greater Ruach HaKodesh than the Ramban and the Rambam. I'd like to believe that they're on the same level. Whether he had Ruach HaKodesh or not, and what exactly Ruach HaKodesh means, I'd like to leave for a separate discussion. But Ramban and Rashi, in fact, halakhically, we go after the Rambam as a general rule. Right? We don't go, Rashi's declaring a halakha based on the Torah. The Rambam is disagreeing. By and large, when it comes to halakha, certainly, maybe not as opposed to abstract perush or ideas, perhaps we tend to follow Rashi. But halakha, we almost always follow the Rambam. So the Rambam is absolutely clear about it. But here's something interesting. The Raibit jumps all over him, and he says, what do you mean in lo hishlimu if they don't make peace with you? They have to also take on the Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach. It's a shibush. The Ramban says it's not a shibush. The close nations do not have to become righteous Gentiles. The only halacha that they have to give up, according to Ramban, is avodah zarah. Because the Torah specifically says that the reason you have to destroy them is so they don't affect you, right? That's what it says in the Torah. You have to destroy them so that you don't come to worship avodah zarah. Again, whether you buy the Rambam and the Ramban is up to you over Rashi. But I can tell you, if a careful read of the Chumash, and I am certainly convinced, not a quick read of the Chumash, but a careful read of the Chumash. If we go on this thesis, though...
Because
the Rambam, not the Ramban, they have to also accept Sharon's Rambam. No, the Rambam says that Amalek only have to be Mishap Mashlinim. The Raibit jumps over him. He says, Shibushu l'chalutin. Says it's a total mistake in the Rambam, because the Rambam should have mentioned Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noah, just like he mentioned with the other nations who are not inside Eretz Israel. I don't think the Rambam made a mistake. The Rambam knew exactly what he was writing. He meant only Hashem, and he agrees totally with the Ramban. According to Ramban, they do not have to become Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noah. They only have to stop worshipping Avodah Zarah, and that's it. In fact, he said that they, even after they make a peace treaty, the Ramban says, if you decide to add another law to them, they have the possibility of rejecting that law as long as it's not Avodah Zarah. That's what the Ramban says. I know this is wild and new idea, and the truth is this even has anything to do with the shir that I'm talking about, except to explain that essentially all of this really has to do with an interesting fact, which is the seven nations and Amalek are supposed to be treated the same. The seven nations, you have to destroy their booty or just their people if they don't make peace. Just the people. Rambam specifically said that the booty you take for yourself. Amalek. Does the Torah ever say, the Torah says what? Wipe out the seed and the memory of Amalek. It never mentions the booty, the goods that one collects from the war, at all. In fact, there ever is a mitzvah in the Torah. Yes, absolutely, Shoal. I'll get to it in a second. That's right. It's a command to Shoal, but I'm talking the Torah. In the Torah, it never mentions that when one must conquer them, one must also wipe out the booty. That one can't take the booty. In fact, there are only two wars where it was expressly commanded not to take the booty. One was with Shaul. You're absolutely right. In fact, let me read you that parak from Shaul. Yeah, I'm sorry. If things are worshipped to Avodah Zarah. And even there, the Gemara states only the things that are actually worshipped to in Avodah Zarah. The Gemara is even cholek on the people. The Chazal say, just don't even think when it says you must wipe out everybody in the town. Efshar, is it possible people never sin? So the Gemara says, no, only the people actually worship to Avodah Zarah. Yes, a thing that has worship Avodah Zarah to it is, in fact, must be burned. So you're saying that Amalek, therefore everything that they had was worship Avodah Zarah to it. I'm going to get there in a second. It's a Rashi. Let me read you the command, because the command seems very strange. Vayomer Shmuel Shaul, Oto Shilach Hashem, Oti Shalach Hashem Mishokal Melech Alamo Yisrael, Vatash Shmal Kol Divrei Hashem. I anointed you as king of Israel. Now listen closely to the command of God. Ko Amar Hashem Tzvot, so says God, Pakadati Et Asher Asam Alek Yisrael. I have remembered what they got, what Amalek did to Israel. Asher Samlo Baderech Ba'alot of Mitzrayim. They attacked them on the way out of Mitzrayim. And destroy everything they have. Have no mercy on them. Destroy man and woman. An older child to a suckling baby. From an ox to a sheep. And from a camel to a donkey. The strange thing about it is, that's not what it says in the Torah. So you could say, like the Eben Ezra says, this is what the Torah meant. In fact, but before we do, I'd like to read your strange Rashi. He's bothered by the Meshor Ba'atzeh. So this is what he says. Very difficult Rashi. Shahayu Bali Kshukim. They were magicians. When the Shani Matzmam, they would transmorgify themselves, Vidomin Lenehima. So they turn themselves into animals. So what you were looking at, that sheep that you're looking at, that ain't a sheep. That's an Amalek in disguise. Therefore, you have to kill him because you have to kill the Amalek. Now, everybody is bothered by this. In fact, Rashi himself, in Parshat Devarim, specifically says that when it says that Timched Zecher Amalek, that you must wipe out all of Amalek, Rashi specifically says, May ish v'yad isha, may olel v'ad yonek. You have to wipe out everything. Women, children, animals, everything. Shelo yehei shem Amalek nizkar. So that you don't even hear the name of Amalek ever mentioned. Afilu al behema. So nobody ever says, oh look, that was an Amalek attack. So why, I ask, and everybody says, Eben Ezra, the Radak on the place says, the reason why you have to destroy these animals is because you're commanded to destroy these animals. You must. First of all, that makes a big difference between the Shiva Amalek, who have the same exact command in the Torah, as the Amalek themselves. The second problem, however, with that, is David's war against the Amalek. Let me read you David's war against the Amalek. David goes to war in Perek Lamed, and it says specifically there,
what happened was David was all fighting actually with the Plishtim. He's going to do an end run around the Plishtim. He's going to attack him from behind, fighting Shaul. The Plishtim are on to David. They know David's going to attack him from behind. So they send David back to a city called Siklag, which was actually in Palestinian custody. It was actually in Plishti territory. What a terrible mistake. Nobody should ever make that mistake, and I apologize. Obviously, I'm thinking too much politics. I got to get off that. So let us take a look at exactly the scope of the war. After he fights and wins the war, by Yikach David et kol atzon v'habakar, he takes from the Amaleki all of the sheep and all of the cattle, nahagul lefnei hamikneh, he carries them in front of all the other cattle, vahu vayomer zesh shlal David, and he says, this is the booty of David. Let me repeat that. He's just come back from the battle. This is David HaMelech, who is anointed king, who certainly is not making any mistakes here. He says, zesh shlal David, all the things that I brought back from Amaleki, this is mine. And then what he does, just in case you think David is running his own little operation, then what happens, it says, Vayavo David al Tziklag, David comes back to his town of Tziklag, Vayishlach me hashalal, and he sends from the booty of the Amaleki, Lezignei Yehuda. He sends them to all the elders of Yehuda, Re'eim le'mor, Hinei lachem bracha, here is a blessing, Mishlal oyvei David, from the booty of the enemies of David. Pretty impressive, right? Lasher b'Beit El, Lasher b'Ramat Negev, Lasher b'Beitar, etc., etc. He sends the booty of Amalek everywhere. It is completely accepted. He calls it a shlal of bracha. So I ask you, if it's an usher from the Torah, then how can you possibly say that David took from the shlal? How can you possibly say such a thing? Not only that, you still have to answer the problem. If the scope is that you must destroy the booty, where does that commandment come from? Why is it only hinted to from the Torah? Why is it not applied to Sheva Amamim? And most importantly, why does Shaul have to do it, but David not have to do it? First question I have to ask. I'd like to go on. Before I answer the question, though, I would like to go on to the question that you had brought up, which is,
Did Shaul do his job?
We know Shaul didn't kill the booty, but now I give you a way out, because maybe he didn't have to kill the booty. In fact, if you remember from last year, I actually said that when Shaul says, when Shmuel comes to Shaul and says, why did you wipe out the booty? He says, I did all that God commanded me and that you commanded me. He seems to be, remember that from last year? He seems to be indicating that, that Shmuel has added on his new laws. What?
Last year, 2 weeks ago.
Oh, it was 2 weeks ago? Oh, okay. Well, I thought I said last week, but...
No, you also...
I mentioned it last week as well?
Last year also.
Oh, okay, good. So it was. Right. Looks like I'm repeating the same shirim over and over and over again. So here's a hint that it may be possible not to destroy. Maybe it's not an intimate to destroy the shlal. But if so, then why did Shmuel, who's clearly not speaking for himself, who's clearly speaking for God, because he goes over and God tells him that he made a mistake because he did not destroy the booty, why would God add in, either way, you're stuck? If it's not a commandment, then why would Shaul be commanded of it, and why would God get really upset when he didn't do it? So the point is, he's going to take away the kingship. I mean, that's a pretty serious sin. If it's not a commandment, if it is a commandment, how could David get away with not doing it? With not only keeping the Shaul, but sending it all over Israel to show what a bracha he had done, a simon bracha for all Bnei Israel. Before I answer that question, I want to talk about the thing that you asked, which was, did Shaul do his job? Did Shaul do his job? The impression is that Shaul did his job except for two things he did wrong. One was Agag, he let Agag live. And the other one is the animals. The first problem that you have with that is, again, if we only read the Haftarah about David fighting all of the Amalekim, we would recognize that there were lots of Amalekim. If Shaul wiped out every... Okay, let's say the Medrash does mean that Agag had a baby that night while he was in chains, which it doesn't, and I'll read it later and explain to you why it doesn't mean that at all. Even so, give me at least a few dozen years until I got enough of a fighting force of Amalek. I got a war against Amalek. In fact, even David was not able to wipe out all of Amalek. By David, it specifically says that 400 people got away. Shaul, well, let's see what it says by Shaul and see if we could justify our comprehension. Let's see where the misunderstanding of Shaul really lies. Why is it? So that, again, first we have a technical problem. If he wiped them out, then where are they? What are they doing there? But there's another issue going on here. If you read the pasuk, if you read the parak carefully, you see that there's something that does not meet the eye immediately, but it's incredibly important. It's in Shmuel Aleph Perek Tet Vav, and Haftarah Parshat Zachor. Let me see why everybody thinks that he did the job.
Did you want to ask something? I know I'm always controversial, Shirim. I hope you don't mind. I'm famous with him. Pasuk Dalet. Let's see if that's right. Yeah. Okay. Let's start from Dalet. It's a good story. Vayishma Shaul et ha'am. He gathers together. Vayishma means he essentially has a call up, a military call up. From the word shama, he sends out a message that they hear that they should come up to fight with Shaul. Vayifkeid b'tzlayim, that he counts them up using cattle. I don't want to get to that yet, but I may. Matayim elef lagi. It's a nice force. It's got 200,000 foot soldiers. Vaseret elefim et ish Yehuda. And there's 10,000 force of Yehuda. I don't want to get into this, but you also already feel the friction that exists between Israel and Yehuda. Vayavo Shaul adir Amalek, vayarev Manachah. I want to read that passage again carefully. Vayavo Shaul adir Amalek, vayarev Manachah. He comes up to the city of Amalek, and he does battle in the river. There's two essential problems with that pasuk. I'll get back to it in a second. Vayomer Shaul al Kini. He speaks to the children of Kini was Yitro's children. L'chu suru du mitoch Amaleki, which means who had joined up with the Amaleki. Very interesting. People who are normally very close ties with Israel are hanging out with the Amaleki. Another thing you have to wonder about. Pen osifcha imo, lest you be wiped out with them. Va'atah asita chesed in Bnei Yisrael. You did good things when you came from Mitzrayim. And the Canaanites listened, they left. Vayach Shaul et Amalek. And Pasuk Zion, this is the one that everybody makes a mistake with. Vayach Shaul et Amalek. And he wiped out Amalek. Mecha bilah bo'acha Shur. From the strip which comes into the Eretz of Shur, which is below the Dead Sea. Below the Dead Sea, which is on the eastern portion of Eretz Israel, in the Negev, Asher al Pnei Mitzrayim, until the face of Mitzrayim. One gets a sense of this pasuk. This is really the one that is misleading. one gets a sense of this pasuk of a total war against the Amalekim. The Amalekim were, by the way, in the Negev. We know this because when the Meraglim are coming back up from going into Eretz Yisrael, they come back and they say, Ephes, no, it's terrible, you can't go up there. First of all, they're giants, and second of all, the Amalekim are in the Negev. So essentially, if you could picture the Negev of Yisrael, essentially pretty much owned by the Amalekim. Therefore, this pasuk says, are we doing on time? But he posted Agag Amaleki Chai. So he essentially, according to Pasuk Zion, he completely battles them from one side of the Negev to the other side of the Negev. But he posted Agag Melech Chai Ve'Kol Ha'am Hecharim L'Pichara. And it says these famous words, Ve'Kol Ha'am Hecharim L'Pichara, and all the nation he kills by the sword. Simple. Right? It's obvious. He kills everybody. But again, we have a contradiction. If he killed everybody, then where did the people come from? So here's something, you thought I was controversial before, now I'm really going to be controversial. Kol doesn't mean kol. Generally speaking, kol, the word kol, all, does not mean all. I could bring you a dozens of proofs. I'll bring the first proof, of course, is by the Makot. If you remember, first it was Barad, and the Barad destroyed all the vegetation, and then the Arba come and eat the vegetation. So Rashi explains it was the vegetation that bent and came back, but even according to that, what that tells you is, kol does not mean kol. What does kol mean? Kol is always subjected to the area where things are involved in. If I say kol ha'edah, all of the tribes, it means all the tribes that are involved in this particular mitzvah, or in this particular event. Let me explain to you what I mean. There's an internal contradiction here, because it says specifically, going back to that difficult pasuk, Vayavo Sha'ul Ir Amalek, to the city of Amalek, Vayara Benachal, which means the battle existed only where? Yeah. Only in the Nachal. There's a contradiction internally. First it says that he came to the city of Amalek and did battle in the city of Amalek in the Nachal. The other problem is, which Nachal? Huh? It almost never does that. If you give me a battle zone, give me a battle zone. I mean, there are 100 Nachals in the Negev. Give me one. The second thing that should bother you is the two words, Ir Amalek. What bothers you about Ir Amalek? Of course. Not only that, they're not supposed to have cities. They're a nomadic tribe. They don't have cities. They go and they attack wherever they're going to be. They have not only a city in Shaul's land, but they've got a peace treaty with the Canaan. We're living in that city. So again, I ask you, was a battle in the city, and if it's a battle in the city, why does it say that they battled them from Chavilah Boach HaShur, which is one side of the Negev, all the way to the other side? The answer to the question, if I may, requires us to look in. It requires us to look at the Battle of David once again. If we take a look in the Battle of David, in Perikov. Wanted. Let me see if I have it here. I'm sorry, my computer conked out and really puts me at a little bit of a stretch. Right, here it is. Vayihi mispar yamim asher yashav David b'stei plishtim. And it was in many, many days, or the number of days, that David sat in the fields of plishtim. This is in a city called Siklag. Yamim va'arba chodashim. He was there for 1 year and 4 months. This is in Siklag, where he ran away to hide with the Plishtim. This is in Shmuel Aleph, Perikop Zion, Pasuk Zion. Vayhi mispar yamim asher yashav David b'stei plishtim, yamim v'arba chodeshim. He was there for a year and 4 months. Vayal David v'anashav, and David came up with his man. Vayipshitu el ha'gshuri, he went to do battle with the Gshuri, or in southern, out to actually southern Israel over the Jordan River, more or less in Saudi Arabia today. V'hagrizi, Vagizri v'ha'amaleki kihema yoshvot ha'aretz. They were the ones who settled the land. Asher me'olam, who always were bo'achashura yad eretz Mitzrayim. Do you see those words? They're repeated, but they're used differently. Here in Shmuel, by the battle of Shaul, it says vayach Shaul otam et ha'amaleki. He battled. He hit the Amaleki. May Chavilashur ad Boach HaMitzrayim, which makes it sound like that's describing the battlefield, right?
Except later on, the second Navi to get involved in writing the Sefer, because Shmuel's already dead, knew that we misread that Pasuk. So he wrote the Pasuk over again by David. Let me read it to you again. Hagizri baha amaleki, comma, who are the amaleki? Ki hine yoshvot ha'aretz. They're the ones who settled the land. Asher me'olam boach ha'shura, who lived from boach ha'shur, ad name it's Ryan. Which means when it says by Shaul that he battled the Amaleki from this place to that place, it's not describing the battlefield. It's describing what? The territory of the Amaleki. You can't read it from Shmuel himself. Shmuel obviously thought that it would be obvious. Natan, who finished the Sefer, knew that it would not be so obvious, so he wrote the same pasuk, but he rewrote it to say that this is where they live from Chavi Lashor Boach HaMitzrayim. So already myth number one is destroyed. The battlefield was not from place A to place B. It was Ad HaNachal. There is no contradiction. Shaul only battled them until the Nachal. Contradiction number two, of course, is the word with Kol. Because here, over by Shmuel, if you take a look at what it says in the next pasuk, it says, and David killed Kol Zahar, every single man, so that nobody would go back to the Plishtim to tell the Plishtim that David was really not on their side. Well, he couldn't have killed all the men of Amaleki. Why? Because he himself was battling the Amaleki less than a year later. Again, the idea of that Kol Zahar is simply not meant to be understood Kol. That's a controversial statement, but if it makes you feel better, I can give you the Gemara's take on the word Kol, which is, as you probably know, which is Rubo Kippur. That is, Kol, first of all, has to be understood within the reference. Did Shaul kill everybody? First of all, probably not. Second of all, if he did kill everybody, it was everybody in the city of the Nachal. What Nachal is it, by the way? That is only understood by David's time. But I want to make sure, let me read to you what happens with David, and then you'll see a massive difference between Shaul's battle. See, at first we thought Shaul's battle was a total war. He killed all the people. Except he couldn't have killed all the people. He only fought up to the city. And he killed all the men. And his only problem is he didn't kill Agag. We've already seen that that's not true. The territory of the battle wasn't there. The people he killed weren't there. The size and scope of Shaul's battle is lessening. But now let's read David's battle and you'll see something very interesting. Vayomer David al Yatara Kohen. David comes back from trying to battle with the Jewish people. He comes back to the city of Tziklag. Tziklag has been destroyed by the Amaleki. He was gone for like a few weeks, destroyed, and his two wives were taken. The people want to kill David. His own people want to kill David. He's mitchazek b'Hashem. He calls on God's support, and he manages the people to go along with them. And they say, come on, what we do? We're going to find the Amaleki. We're going to beat them. We're going to get all of our stuff back and their stuff too. Listen to what he says. God asks David, he has the Urim between him, Erdof acharei hagdud hazeh, shall I chase after the Amaleki? Ha'asigenem, will I capture it? Vayomer lo radof, ki hasei tasik batzel tatzil. You will do it, you will win, go fight them. Vayelach David hu v'sheish meot ish asher ito, vayavo ad hanachal. He comes to the river. Habesor, now we know the name of the river, this is in Perek Lamed Pasuk Tet. Vahanotarim amadu, and all the people who were tired, he let them stay at the river. Keep in mind that a river is an incredibly difficult thing to cross. Remember the old stories in the westerns where it takes a big deal to cross a river, and even like the bridge over the river Kwai. Rivers are strategic events that if you hide behind the river, you have a chance of survival. The Amaleki see them coming, and they go beyond the river. Trying to take a river and move beyond it is something which takes courage and guts, and it takes a total approach to war. So he has all these tired people going across the river. He leaves them where they are. By Yerdolf David hu barbami odish, he takes 400 who weren't tired. By Amdu matayimish asher pagru, and he takes the 200 people that were tired. He leaves them on the river Besor. But the 400 people, those he takes with them. By Yimtzu ish mitzri, he finds this mitzri guy, and he finds out where exactly the Amalekim are hiding out. I'm going to skip over to Pasuk. Tet Zion. Vayoriduhu, he took all his troops down, he named Ochima, Pnekol Aretz. They're over the entire breadth of the land. Ochlim, Mishotim, they're eating and drinking, Chogigim, the Kol Ashlag Gol. They're really enjoying all the stuff that they stole from David, that they pillaged from David. Vayakim David me'aneshef ad erev. He wiped them out in a non-stop war, day and night, l'makoratam, until the next day. Lo nimlat mehem ish ki'im arba me'os. No person got away except for 400. You see, when the Torah says call, it's not really clear how many you're talking about. But when the Torah says he destroyed them, everything excluding 400 people, that's when the Torah is trying to give you a precise count. We're running out of time, so I'm going to sum up instead of trying to prove more textually. What we've seen here is that there is a difference between Shaul's war and David's war. And there's another difference which is also important to state. So hopefully I've answered the question of how is it possible that he only allowed Agag to survive? And the answer is, he did not allow only Agag to survive. That is, it is not correct. It can't be correct. And we could prove it textually. But there's another important difference which gets back to the Shalal. I want to return to the Shalal question. If we say that there's no command, and I would prefer to say that there is no command to destroy the Shalal, to destroy the booty, why in fact was Shaul given that command? And I go with that idea because the Rambam says that it's not true. I like to believe this comparison to Shimon and Amalek. We see that David enjoys the Shalal. In general, Shalal is free game. It's booty. The Rambam specifically says that you're allowed to take from their Shalal. In which case, it's not really a question of why David was able to take the Shalal. The real question is why was Shaul given this extra command not to take the Shalal? And I think in order to answer that question, you need to go back to the only other battle where the Shalal, the booty, was not allowed to be used. And that one battle where they had to destroy everything, man, women, children, and burn everything in the city, was none other than... What? Actually, before the battle of the Ayai, they were allowed to take the Shalal. It was Yericho. Yericho. What is the comparison between the battle of Shaul and Yericho? There are two comparisons. And also, here is where you read the single parts. It's a little difficult to understand. Right before the battle against the Amaleki, Shaul had another battle against the Plishtim. He fights them, and he tells people, don't eat a single piece of food. Don't touch anything. Yonatan does not hear him. Yonatan takes the stick, he dips it to the honey, and he touches it to his mouth. And everybody says, oh no, you're not allowed to do that. He said, oh, my father has destroyed us, because if we were strong enough, if we would just eat a little bit, we wouldn't be so tired. We'd be able to chase the Plishtim all the way down to their territory, down by Aza, and we'd be able to destroy them. But Yonatan was partially wrong, because what happened as soon as the people took a little bit of food? It says specifically, I'm not going to read it inside, that they sat on the Shalal, that is, they attacked the Plishtim in the middle of Eretz Israel, and when they were allowed to eat by Yonatan, they started eating, and that's why they stopped chasing the rest of the people. It was a lose-lose situation. Shaul told them that they're not allowed to eat. And that's a good reason not to chase people down 50 miles because you don't have enough strength. On the other hand, Shaul knew something that Yonatan, and this is maybe Yonatan's one flaw, that Yonatan did not understand, which is the people weren't really listening to Shaul. When Shaul tells them, don't eat anything, they say the worst words a king should ever hear. Anachnu naseh hatova shar be'inecha. We'll do what you tell us to do. That is not a good thing to say to the king. That's what we'll do. Because Shaul knew that they were the type of people that if they took from the Shalal, they would stop the war. That's actually what happened. And in fact, one has reason to believe that it happens here as well. In fact, what does Shaul say when Shmuel comes? Shaul is not really lying. Shmuel comes and says, what is Mehakolatzona there? What's the voice of this cattle among the people? You know why Shaul didn't pursue the war? Because keep in mind, the question is, if he didn't kill everybody like he said he did, if he stopped the war at the city, at the Nakal, that David went way over and continued the battle, if it was a too small war, then why does God not mention the fact that he didn't kill everybody? Why does he specifically mention the booty and Agag? And the answer, I think, is obvious. Because the booty is what caused the people not to want to do what? Not want to fight. And then Shaul said, what was I supposed to do? That was what Shaul meant. What was I supposed to do? The nation wanted the cattle. They sat down. They're doing Tzvachim. They're eating. They're having fun. They're not pursuing the battle. How does this contrast with David? David's people, when he gets back to Ziklag, they want to kill him. They come to him. They say, we're going to kill you. He says, no, no. You're not allowed to. This is not the right thing. We have to go and do battle. And you know what they do? They listen to him. The second thing that happens in the same battle is a very strange story. Who cares about how many people sit on the buoy? Right? This is all, it returns to the buoy. I do a battle, there are a lot of people tired at the same river Shaul is out. I leave 200 people behind, 400 of us go on, and we win all the booty. You know what happens? You guys, do you know what the story happens when they return, the 400 people, what they say about the 200 people? Why are they allowed to take it? They didn't do any fighting. We're taking all the stuff. They get nothing. Do you remember this part? And what does David say? David said, "Nal narei, don't act like this. The people who are sitting, the non-fighters, have as much of a portion as the produce for the job that they're doing as the fighters do." And the parsha ends off, "Kacha yaseh choku mishpat v'Yisrael." And that law that David decreed right there was made an eternal law for Eretz Israel. David, look at the contrast between Shaul and his people and David and his people. Shaul is overwhelmed by his people. He does not push his people. He doesn't want to push his people. David is pushed by his people and he pushes them back and makes them do the right thing. And finally, let's end off with the spiritual. I'm sorry, I'm going a little over time. Let's end off with why we have to, the question why we have to kill Amaleki altogether. That is, I said because God told us to. But what does that mean? Why did God, in fact, cause us to be so vicious against Amalek that we have to wipe out everybody? And the pasuk itself in Shmot says it. It said, "Ki yad al kesia mochama in Yisrael im Amalek dor l'dor." Every nation has to fight Amalek. Every nation, because yad al kesia. What does kesia mean? It's short for kisei, the seat of, and yah is short for God. All the midrashim, all the mepharshim jump on this and they say, why did it write kesia? The hand should be on the seat of God. Why did it cut off the word kes from kisei and yah from yukub? Okay, because ein shmi shalem ve ein kisei shalem. Neither my nation, my name is not whole, nor is my seat, which is going to be Beit HaMikdash, by the way, which is why you have to wait to destroy Amalek before going to Beit HaMikdash, nor is my seat whole until Amalek is destroyed. But the question is, why? So I know you've heard all the drushim on it, and they're probably all true, but I'd like to tell you the pshat, and here you have to know a little bit of geography. Before the story of Amalek was a very bad story. Are you familiar with what happened right before Amalek attacked? They're in a city called Rephidim. Ve'en lehem, mayim l'shtos. They don't have water to drink. The first time. Moses commanded to go and hit the rock the first time, talk to the rock the second time, hit the rock the first time. Where is the rock? The rock is in Horeb, which is another name for Har Sinai. But we know, because the Torah tells us, that Har Sinai is a 3-day walk from Rephidim. We also know who went up to the mountain to get the water. It says specifically, the Moshe v'kol zkenim asher haya ito. Think about it. The people, this is pure Menachem Levtag, if you're curious, you can read this online. The people are sitting there, the women, the children, they're thirsty. They're not joking. They're thirsty. They're going to die. Maybe they should have more belief in God. Maybe they shouldn't have more belief in God. Separate issue. But there's no question that they're dying of thirst in the desert. Water, Moshe goes on a 3-day walk, strikes a rock here, and the water comes essentially pouring off of Har Sinai on a 3-day new river all the way to Rephidim. As soon as the people see the water, guess what happens? Run to the source. Who's left behind? This Kenim are with Moshe, the Torah tells us, with Yahushua, by the way, up by HaChorev. Who's left behind in Rephidim? Women and the children. I'd like to talk, and I'd like to, and again, I'll end this with, I'm sorry for going over time. I'd like to mention what Soloveitchik said based on Ishei Kabbalah. He quotes the Kabbalistic scholars, but he says that he's famous for saying it. In fact, they offered him. What I heard from Rav Heshi Reichman, one of his students, was that he was a very big Zionist. He was very involved in the Mizrahi movement, and they had offered him a job of being chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. And what Rabbi Reichman told us, his students in YU, I remember this a long time ago, is that he rejected the job for a few reasons, but one of the main reasons is when they were discussing reparations from Germany, the Rav said they may not take reparations from Germany because Germany is like Amalek. Well, wait a second. Germany's not Amalek. Amalek is B'nai Esav, they don't exist anymore. If the Shiva Amamim don't exist anymore, then Amalek doesn't exist anymore. But the Rambam and the Anshei Kabbalah being Medayik in the Rambam himself. The Rambam, when he talks about Amalek and Shiva Amamim, mention them together. But the only people he say don't exist anymore is not Amalek, he says the Shiva Amamim. What the Rav says, and I think it's absolutely true, is that any nation, I just read an article actually about Jean Kirkpatrick. Remember Jean Kirkpatrick? She said there's two different types of nations that you don't like, that are not democratic.
One are totalitarian, one are authoritarian. Authoritarian, the people like to be in charge, they like to control the people, but their movement is nationalistic perhaps, power-based, but it's not ideological. It's not that they're willing to fight and die for an ideology, they fight and die for the power base. A totalitarian, and she said, with ideological nations, you're allowed to try to make peace. You could try to convince them and make trade with them, because if it's non-ideological, if it's authoritarian, there's a chance they may come around and see things the way you see them. She said a totalitarian nation, such as the Soviet Union, is not basing itself on desire for country conquest or for money. It's not about money. It's not about territory. It's an ideology that I can exist, and your ideology is inherently valueless. Not only valueless, but needs to be destroyed. So based on this, what the Rav Soloveitchik said is that any nation that wants to destroy Israel, not because they're sharing the same piece of land, and again, I'm staying away from politics. I'll enter into politics. Any nation any nation that can send their children is an ideological war. I think it's no longer a war about countries. I'm not speaking about Arabs in general. I hate to do politics, but I'm not speaking about the Arab people. They're not Shiva Amalim. Nobody should ever make that mistake. Whether they're Amalek or not is not based on their racial attributes. It's based on what they do. I begin to wonder whether the Palestinian people are an Amalek. I didn't used to believe it, but I think I believe it now. I don't believe Jordan's an Amalek. I don't believe Egypt's an Amalek. I believe there are issues of money and control and power and territory. But certainly in some areas in the Arab world, it seems to be very much Amalek-based. Now let me step back and become a Tanakh teacher as opposed to a politician. Amalek. The reason why the king's job after destroying Amalek is build a Beit HaMikdash so that God could take his presence. Because Amalek is a very antithesis to the philosophy of the Jewish people. I know you've heard this before, but I was hoping with my little play about how they attack the women and the children for no reason, except the fact that they're women and children, they can destroy them. There's no money there. There's no conquest to fight. I'm a big soldier. They were killing women and children for the sake of killing women and children. There wasn't a land grab. The Bnei Israel were leaving. They knew they were leaving. They were on their way. They were on their way out. It was done only for ideological reasons. That is a direct antithesis to what the Jewish people are about. That's why a king has to be able to destroy Amalek. I heard Rabbi Yoel ben Nun say, listen, the Jewish religion is very tough. Think about killing every woman and man and child if they don't make peace with you. It's a tough thing to do. But sometimes, there are some ideological battles, not many, but there's some ideological battles. I'm sorry, please.
No.
That they're Amalek. That's a great story. The Rav actually mentioned another, the Tsar. The Rav mentioned a Hasidish rabbi it wasn't the Baal Shem Tov, but he also mentioned that they went to see the Tsar and then they both came out of the meeting and they said that this is Amalek. So it's another very similar story, right? In fact, the Rav doesn't even say it himself. I heard him on tape. He says that it's from Divrei Kabbalah, which means the Kabbalists go back, of course, to the 1500s. So I'm sure even before the Vilna Gaon and even before the Tsar story, there were also other Amalekim. So the concept that it's a ideological people. Now, of course, you could say, well, maybe the people that David fought were a new Amalek, but that's not mashma from the Pesukim.
Sure. Maybe the reason Hashem was to prove that Shur was specifically told what to do. Because isn't that what Shmuel said to him? What if Hashem doesn't want you to do? If he wants you to do what he tells you to do, then if he did not tell that to David.
That is absolutely correct. But I believe, as with all mitzvot, that there's a reason for the mitzvah. That's true. Theoretically, if he would have told Shaul to wear blue pants on Tuesday, and he hadn't done that, then Shaul would have been just as evil. I have a hard time with that philosophically, although I know it's a viable philosophical idea. I believe that while it's true, Hilo Shamata Devrei Hashem, Hashomea Mizevach Tov, Kichatat Kesem Meri, the offering of a magic man is bitter. I think it's true that you could say it could have been any law, but I believe it goes beyond that. I think it had to specifically be destroying Amalek. And in fact, the only way to destroy Amalek, the only way to destroy an entire ideology, is to be able to move an entire people. So Shaul's failure with the Amaleki was the same as his failure to move an entire people. and David's success. That's what do we need to know about the people taking the shlal? Who cares? He just let Agag live, and that's bad enough. No, you have to understand that he was not able to control his own people. Not only that, when he's accused of crimes, he even blames his own people. He's not with them. David's story, which is an exact match but successful, we have two separate incidents where his people want to kill him or go against David, and David says, no, 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 you're going to do things my way, and they listen to him. And that contrast, I think, is crucially important, because it's impossible to battle Amalek without having the people behind you. And the last thing I'd like to say about Agag, and then I'm going to, and then the show will be over, is I believe he wanted Agag to live. For the same reason he let Agag build a city. For the same reason he allowed the Agagis to get to the Canaan. Because Shaul didn't feel the ideological war. He didn't see what the problem with Amalek was. He thought Amalek were like the Plishtim. He thought the Amalek were like the Midjanim. He was unable to identify the ideological problem. He was unable to move his people to fight an ideological problem that didn't exist. And ultimately, if that reason that he could not become the king. On the other hand, David, who recognized the ideological problem and recognizes that he has to essentially control his own people to kill the ideological problem, he is the successful king, which is why the first person he meets afterwards is the young boy who comes back from the battlefield holding the tefillin of Shaul in his hand saying, I saw Shaul die. And that's a story that I'm not going to tell today, so I'll pretty much end with that. Thank you very much.